Assalamu alaikum everyone. This particular podcast, as you know, features Hamza Sotsis. Hamza is a British public speaker. He's an essayist and a researcher on Islam that is already probably well known to those who listen to this podcast. He came to Australia sometime in 2016. This particular podcast was recorded during that time. Specifically, I should say it was recorded in Canberra on top of the Telstra Tower. In the background, you can probably hear some of the people who happen to be in the same cafe on the highest structure in Canberra. For that reason, I was somewhat hesitant as to whether or not I should be sharing this interview with you, as I'd like to keep the quality at a good level. A friend advised me that there was no harm in using this particular recording, as the background noise probably adds to the general ambience. In any case, here it is.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We're with you on the top of Telstra Tower, 850 meters above, you know, Black Mountain, as it's called, with Hamza Sotsis. How do you pronounce your name, by the way?
Sotsis.
What does it mean?
It doesn't mean anything. It's just a surname. I don't think it means anything.
Right.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Enjoying your coffee?
It's not a coffee, it's a chai.
Chai, yeah. Well, this is quite a nice latte, actually. Very nice. So, how are you, Sheikh?
I'm good, alhamdulillah.
Good. How's family?
Family's good. We're interviewing you, not...
So, what are you going to ask me?
Okay. So, how long have you been Muslim? This is a very basic question. I apologize for how basic it is, but how long have you been a Muslim?
I've been a Muslim for 10 years. 10 years, 10 years, and I believe we're coming to the 11th year, inshallah. So, it's been an interesting journey ever since.
Right.
Ups and downs as life is.
All right.
Hitting the floor, bouncing back up,
inshallah.
But yeah, it's been alhamdulillah. Obviously, it's the greatest decision anyone could really make, to be honest.
Inshallah. You have an amazing story about how you came to Islam. If you don't mind, could you please share that with our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I was brought up by Greek parents. My mum's from Cyprus. She came to the United Kingdom in 1974 or 1975 after the Turkish invasion of Cyprus. My dad came to England in 1973 and he came from Athens. He originally was... He wasn't AWOL, but he was quasi-absent without leave because he was in a marine college. And because my dad had hippie spiritual ideas, he was disheartened with the Marines. And one of his best friends actually passed away in a military accident. And he would say that his friend's smile was like my smile. And I think his friend's name was Andreas as well. That's my Greek name, Andreas. Anyway, my dad came. He was homeless for a while, I think for about 9 months. And eventually he got into the clothing business. I mean, he was like a sort of bookkeeper, accountant, but he couldn't find anything. And we were brought up in an area called Hackney, which in the 1980s could be described as a ghetto. I remember the flats that we were living in for the first 14 years of my life. It was built in a ditch. And it was constructed in such a way where you could see that it facilitated delinquency and juvenile behavior. And interestingly, as a side note, if you study the environmental psychology, you see that there's been a lot of studies on the effects of buildings on behavior. And they've seen that if you build ghetto-like buildings, built in ditches, with small alleyways and paths, and it's surrounded by walls, if you like, it would facilitate delinquency and juvenile behavior. Anyway, so I came from that environment, and I went to school there. And my dad, basically, from a religious perspective, wouldn't really teach us anything concerning religion in any shape or form. what he would be doing is he would basically teach us his kind of new age spiritual ideas, although he still is a lover of Jesus alayhi salam, but not of dogma or religion or the Bible. And he would teach us like self-empowerment stuff. I remember he had this book called The Power of Positive Thinking by Vincent Beale, I believe. And, you know, he would have these type of books, self-empowering books, existential books, books about who are you, why are you, whose are you. He also had books about mysticism. He had audio tapes about Hinduism and Sikhism and other traditions. So he was quite an open-minded fellow. And that's what we were brought up in, a perspective of, you know, we weren't very nationalistic. Well, we weren't brought up with Greeks anyway. We had like blacks and Turks and whites and Asians and Pakistanis around us. It was quite multicultural. So we weren't brought up like that at all. Although we did go to Greek school on Saturdays. And I used to hate it because the Greek schools were usually middle class. And I came from a working class background. I just didn't relate to them. I thought they were just like stuck up and on another planet. And they just like, you know, would define themselves by the way they looked a lot. Greek culture sometimes can be, especially a modern Greek culture, for middle classes, can be about what you have, what you earn, who you are in terms of your profession. And it's extremely shallow. Well, I find it extremely shallow, meaningless. And that's why I didn't really engage with these people. I couldn't really interact with them. And a good kind of example of this is when we first started doing A-levels, I think, at the Greek school. We did A-level Greek literature, which actually was my favorite subject, because literature was like analyzing thoughts, really, and I just loved doing that. Anyway, so the priest, he was a teacher and a priest at the same time, because usually the Greek schools are attached to churches. He would sit us down, all the class, or all the group, the year group, and he would ask every single one, what makes you Greek? Because don't forget, the Greek church is very nationalistic. Even if you hear the Orthodox hymns and prayers, you know, they will say things like Kyrie sorsetou laosou, which is basically, oh Lord, sort out your people. And people translate that as the Greek people, because the Orthodox Greek church would be like Ellenike Christiane Lae, which is the Greek Christian community. Anyway, so he would ask everybody, what makes you Greek? And everyone's got their own things, you know, the language, the culture, this, that, the other. He came to me and I said, well, you know, I've been brought up not to really see myself as Greek and have no national boundaries and stuff. And then everyone was silent, thinking, who's this clever guy thinking he's smart? And then the priest looked at me and it was like almost pin drop silence. And he looked at me and he said, well, that's a Greek idea as well. And everybody started to laugh. So that would summarize my kind of attitude at Greek school. Anyway, so I remember my dad, when we were like 7, 8 years old, who would sit us down and basically talk to us about so many deep things I didn't really understand, to be honest. And we had to sit there for 2 hours just listening to my dad. And my dad, bless him, was very sincere. He really wanted to get us to understand these ideas, but I think we were too young. We were too young. But yeah, so my dad's a very loving guy. So we're brought up in that kind of environment. And as I was growing up, I always had those kind of ideas. I don't really remember how I was, but I've asked like old school friends, and they always ask me, you know, you were kind of like hippie, happy-go-lucky, get along with everyone kind of guy, compassionate guy, but also had a rough edge to me as well. You know, I mean, if I were to describe my character now, it would be an alpha beta male. Because I'm an alpha male as well, because I do emotionally react a lot. I have emotional tsunamis, but I also could be quite thoughtful as well, and quite, you know, look 5 years ahead and think about a strategy and think. So I think I'm both, and that is quite a dangerous combination sometimes, I think. So I'm an alpha beta male.
Yes.
Maybe you know, bordering schizophrenic. I don't know. Maybe one of those things. But anyway, so. Yeah, so my dad facilitated that kind of disposition that I have. And as I was growing up in college and secondary school, I was always very kind of motivated to learn other ideas. Hence, I would read about other traditions. I would love things like Kung Fu and go to the kind of Shaolin Kung Fu in the basement. I used to learn still the wire mantis. I used to read about Chinese herbal medicine. I was learning Mandarin at one point. I was into Tibetan Buddhism.
So were you a Buddhist at that time?
Well, I don't know if I was a Buddhist, but I was interested in those ideas. I was like a healthy agnostic. So I'll be thinking about these different ideas. Maybe it's like a search of meaning, search for meaning. Because that is what describes human beings, really, is their search for meaning. And I think we neglect that when we're discussing with other people. Because sometimes we think it's very kind of abstract and we need to prove this and prove that and show this and show that. But I don't think that's healthy. We need to mix it with, you know, making it contingent, making it dependent on things that are quite meaningful, that really, you know, pull the heartstrings in the right way. And the Quran is full of that, as Allah Jalla wa Ala, He talks about, if you forget Allah, Allah will make you forget your own self. So that, in a way, is giving meaning to remembering Allah. Do you see? Because you forget Allah, it's like forgetting who you are, your self-identity, your sense of self, your sense of who you are, your sense of understanding, your sense of being a holistic human being. But yeah, so I had this search for meaning. So I would always be engaged with these different types of discussions with different types of people on a whole range of topics. And I was actually introduced to Islam formally when I was in secondary school, which is like high school, early high school. And, you know, I would be interested in the Muslim behavior. He wouldn't do this, he wouldn't do that, he would have this type of attitude towards things. So that just made me want to read more. And then when I went to college, the kind of thinking about man life in the universe got a bit more serious. And I'll be thinking and understanding and trying to understand different cultures. And I remember at that time I picked up a lot. So with my Muslim friends, I'll be like, yeah, Allah. And I would say, Subhanahu wa ta'ala. And when I say Muhammad, I'll say, Sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And I'll be engaging with the culture. And obviously at that time, you obviously interacted with females as well. So I'll see Muslim sisters with hijab, and I actually found that quite attractive. Not attractive from a physical point of view, but from a spiritual, emotional point of view. It's like, there's something different about these people. There's something, you know, almost warm and spiritual about, you know, what these people are. So that was attractive to me. And also the kind of sense of honor that the brothers had, and a sense of dignity and brotherhood that was quite powerful. And I remember one brother who was studying to be a medic, his name was Dr. Amir. And now he's my good friend. And I was a non-Muslim then, and he would just basically say some amazing gems that would hit you home, you know? And his whole attitude and approach to how he would live the religion in terms of, I think he was an honorable guy. He was like a Muslim samurai, basically. You know, honorable, do things with ihsan, and, you know, have that kind of mentality and have a stance on things, you know? And when you have a stance on things, it actually gives meaning to yourself. Because if you're always compromising your ideas, then there's no meaning. There's no meaning. So he would have a stance about how to treat women and how to treat people. And if people deviate from that stance, he would actually defend it. And sometimes he would even defend it physically. So that was I found that quite honorable with someone like that. And in saying that, he was actually a trainer for the English wrestling team. Yeah, no, he's actually a all-round brother, mashallah, may Allah preserve him. So, you know, I would be meeting people like this would have an influence. And he probably wouldn't have no idea. I've never told him this. He would think, how did I influence him? No way. And that's why you should never underestimate things that you say and do.
Yeah.
Wallahi, it's the power of that is phenomenal. Mm. I remember when I was working as a program office manager, and I was working for the government, and it was for like children's services, and there'll be sociologists there and social workers. And they would tell me these stories that, you know, I said one thing to one guy, actually was violent. I pushed him up onto the wall, this youth, and said, what are you doing with your life? And I said all these things. And the guy would be telling me I was quite unethical, or he was coming across that way. And after 10 or 15 years, he meets that same person, and that person's now a banker, he's successful, and he came from a crazy background. And he would speak to the social worker and say, you know, if you never said that to me, that thing to me that day, I would never have changed my life. And this social worker was like, oh my God, you know, don't underestimate anything that you say. So it was quite powerful.
It's amazing.
So And then after I went to university and I first tried to study human physiology, but I hated it. I didn't understand the idea of being in labs all the time. Then I changed to psychological science, and then I changed to psychology. Pointless degree, really. But I was doing that for a while. And my experience at uni was quite interesting. It was a big culture shock for me because I hated it. University was the most worst time in my life. I hated people. They were like backstabbing. It was about, you know, your status and what you look like. I remember I used to be the kind of kid that would wear the same jumper 3 days in a row. I had this jumper, it was green, and it had performance on it. And I would wear it 3 days in a row. And, you know, it wasn't day. I'm clean, having shower. I'm always very clean. We'd have showers every day. But they'd be like, you know, what's up? And I'd be like, what's the matter with you people? I mean, how does it define who you are? I mean, I didn't get it. I just didn't get it. I just didn't get it. Anyway, and, you know, I would always help people in terms of, like, you know, I had a girlfriend at the time, or a friend, whatever you call it. And she had a single mom, and her friend was a single mom. And her friend needed help to do this, like, physiology dissertation or something. And we had about 12 hours. And they asked me for help. And I was the kind of guy that if you gave me the books, I could do it. So I had, like, 12 books. Had to do the thing for her. Anyway, I managed to do it just for her. And she got, like, a 2-1, which is, like, an upper second class degree. I used to be that kind of person that would just, like, you know, kind of be self-sacrificial for people. But in reality, it's not self-sacrificial at all. It's everything you do is for yourself anyway. Because I don't believe in, like, altruism. Because you're doing it because the pain of not doing it is worse. So that's why. Like, you know, Rachel Corrie, she got bulldozed by the Zionists. Now, she was there because the pain of not being there was worse than being there. So ultimately, you could reduce human motivation to pain and pleasure. And I'm not saying it in a shallow sense. I'm saying it, you know, there's different types of pains and different types of pleasure. And that's why Allah Jalla wa'ala always talks about the worst type of pain, which is Jahannam, and the best type of pleasure, which is seeking His face and actually enjoying eternal bliss with Allah Jalla wa'ala. Because human beings want to run away from pain. It's just normal. You know, you could philosophize about it and think that, you know, you're self-sacrificial and you're compassionate, but frankly, that's all, like, you could just reduce it to pain or pleasure. The pain of you not doing anything is worse than the pain of you doing something. That's why people usually do something. Anyway, where was I? Yeah, so I was helping this person out, and that would be kind of my character. But what happened once was I was doing a second year dissertation or something about research methods, advanced research methods. And my friends were like, oh, we don't have enough time. And we had to give the paper in at 5 o'clock on a Friday or something. Everyone's rushing. And I finished the piece before everybody, and they wanted to steal my conclusion because they will fail otherwise. So I gave it to them like an idiot. And then after we got caught for plagiarism, they didn't know who was the victim, who was the one doing the crime, if you like. And so we had to repeat the whole year just doing one module. I was really angry. I mean, I lost some really good friends. I had one good friend called Howard Eugene. I was 20 at the time. He was 27, older than me. I looked up to him. He was a new age spiritualist type. He was very kind of conspiratorial as well. But, you know, I looked up to him, you know. We used to connect in some ways. And our relationship broke from then because, you know, he thought I actually grasped them up. But I didn't because I had to retake the year as well. Anyway, so in that year, I said to myself, you know what? I'm going to do that module in the evening, but I'm going to do something with my life. So I managed to get a job for the police IT organization. It was a very kind of freakish thing because it was quite a good job. It was as a student placement, but you got paid, and they gave you like £15,000, English pounds, equivalent of training. Prince do training, PMI training, ISEB training, which is professional qualification project management. So I said, I'm not going back to uni. I'm just going to become a project management consultant, and that's what I did. So I was one of the youngest consultants, would work for like American military company, I would work for the criminal justice system, work for the government, international business change company called Scott Wilson. So I did some good things. But in that process, especially in that year at the police IT organization at the time, it's now been disbanded, I was reading about Islam and Buddhism. And Christmas came along, I had a Christmas party, boat party, I met an interesting lady, of Muslim origin, and I was like really shocked that she was in that kind of environment, because I knew about the culture, right? Remember right. I said about the hijab and right. honor and stuff, but she wasn't like that, obviously. She's in the boat party drinking. So I sit her down saying, hey, you shouldn't really be here, what's going on, this is ridiculous. And she thought, you know, who is this guy, Mufti or something. So I'm just chatting with her and we exchange numbers and we become friends and we have some kind of relationship, if you like. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I was always like talking to her about Islam because I was just interested, and I had this book by one of the Egyptian scholars. It was called Islamic Focus. Yeah. It's quite a good book, actually.
Right.
It just summarizes Islam, society and prayer and stuff like that. Anyway, so she had to go get married. I was quite depressed because obviously I fell in love, whatever, yeah? But then I find out that as a result of our connection, she starts praying 5 times a day and she wears hijab. Inshallah. So I was really shocked. And that created an impetus for me to think about the tradition further. And, you know, I was becoming more convinced. My friends were talking to me about Islam and that God is a reality. He's one, that this Quran is a miraculous book. This is how God announced himself to mankind. So I was convinced with that. But there was a problem, because my conviction didn't lead to kind of any emotional action or spiritual action. So what I did was almost give up. But then I started praying. I remember in the prayer, I remember the guy, you know, Dr. Amir, he used to say to me, you're closer to God when you're in prostration. Talk to him. I remember that from the college time. So I used to talk to God saying, sort me out, help me. I scream at him. Yeah, almost. And so I was praying regularly. I mean, not 5 times. I mean, I wasn't a Muslim, but I was going to the mosque and stuff.
Right.
I remember getting in trouble by an imam as a non-Muslim because my t-shirt was a bit short, and you know the back was showing a bit, the outer.
Right.
And I didn't understand what he was saying. I was like, "Who's this guy?"
But you still went to the masjid.
Yeah, I still went to the masjid. Yeah, it's quite funny because there were Muslims who wouldn't even go to the masjid at all, and they get in trouble once and they never go back. But I still wanted to go back. Anyway, so I was praying and stuff and reading Quran, and I actually learned Surah Fatiha and the short surahs before I turned Muslim. Anyway, so I did that when I went to Greece for a holiday as well. And then I came back and I almost gave up. And my friend saw me one evening and he said, okay, what's going on? You should take the jump. And he talked to me about death. He did it in such an amazing way.
Yeah.
So the next day I became a Muslim. I think it was October the 5th, 2002? Yeah, 2002, I think. So, that's how I became a Muslim.
Inshallah.
Yes, that's it, really. And then it's been very interesting ever since.
Inshallah.
Obviously.
One of the things that the converts usually struggle with when they first became Muslim is, you know, praying all the 5 daily prayers on time and praying them properly in one day. Was that a problem that you faced when you first entered the fold of Islam?
No, it was a problem I faced after.
Right.
In the beginning, it was easy. You know, I would spend like days in the mosque. I lost connection with some of my friends, and I just stayed in the masjid. I'd go there for Fajr, go back to sleep, go there for Dhuhr, Asr, and I would stay in the masjid. And actually, I'll teach some kids, help them with the primary school homework.
In the masjid,
yeah. So it was after, when you get out of the kind of honeymoon period, that's it really. That's when it's more problematic. It's more difficult.
Good way of putting it.
Yeah, because in the beginning it's like, you know, you have a spiritual high and you know these things are relatively easy, but it's when Shaitan comes back from a little break. And really wants to, you know, Barsisa the monk style.
Right.
Really like starts from small things and ends up with big things. So it was after it was more problematic, and that's when you need people around you.
Right. So is this what you would advise to those giving dawah to recently converted Muslims?
Yeah, you have to focus on the prayer. Because some people focus on like hijab and beard and clothing and trousers and this and that and everything. And you know, you give them all the do's and don'ts. You know, you give them the rabbinical laws, the 613 laws. And I think that's wrong. I think the most important thing you need to establish is the salah, because it's a manifestation of the tawheed, and it reinforces everything. And if it's from there, things will grow. Because, you know, There's no point giving the rulings. Look what Aisha said, radiallahu anha. If Allah Jalla wa'ala started with rulings, no one would listen. So, you know, change their framework, their mental and spiritual framework, the kind of world view, make sure it's established, and that is re-emphasized with the prayer. And it reminds me of the hadith. It may be misapplied, but it reminds me of this, the following hadith of Mu'adh bin Jabal when he went to Yemen. And the Prophet said, you know, talk to them about Tawheed. If they agree, then talk to them about the prayer. If they establish the prayer, then talk to them about Zakah, and it continues. So, I mean, I'm not for gradualism, because once you're Muslim, you know, what's halal is halal and what's haram is haram, but there's a process, and you can't start talking about, you know, for example, you know, detailed fiqh about economics when, you know, the guy doesn't even pray. Mm-hmm. So you need to really establish that. That's the most important thing.
Right.
I think with the problem with me, I think the people around me was like, no, you have to talk about this and talk about that, and you have to understand this and that, and then you think you're mufti, because you don't know anything, you don't even have to pray, man. Mm-hmm. So I think the prayer is the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. So after that, obviously you're well known for your talks at Hyde Park, your debates, and some of your essays and articles.
Sure.
So is this something you started doing immediately after becoming a Muslim, or how did you enter?
Well, I started talking about the religion straight away because I've always had an alpha beta mentality, yeah? So I always wanted to like express myself to my parents, to family, to my friends. And, you know, I remember even when I used to love Kung Fu, for example, like Wing Chun Kung Fu, I used to do that. I should want to sell it to everybody as well. It's something you like, enjoy, you know the truth of it. Talk about it, act upon it, do it. I was always like that. I never understood you not talking about the thing that you enjoy. So it was just a natural thing for me. So I started from the beginning, I guess. And it's just evolved, if you like, into like more formal things like giving lectures and doing debates with academics and writing.
Right.
And it's not perfect. I mean, things have evolved over time.
Of course.
And that's life, and that's why the ulama, they say the one who has never done a mistake in the Dao before has never done Dao before.
Mm. So where did this idea of debating with atheists come from?
I think it's because when they started to become popular, when Richard Dawkins' book came out, then I felt that there was a lot of pressure against the Muslim and the creed of Islam and our worldview. Because before, I used to talk to Christians and lots of different people, and also getting maybe dabbled into like politics in terms of dealing with secularism. But then I jumped into the atheism thing because I felt in the West that's a growing phenomena, and people want certainty, and that's one of the human needs. They want certainty. So dealing with atheists is also dealing with Christians and also dealing with humanists and also dealing with everybody else, because the kind of arguments or the things that you talk about is going to be something that's sufficient for everybody, because it's going to establish or facilitate conviction. So, yeah, the atheist movement, I mean, I actually take my hat off. Since post 9/11, within 10 years, in England, for example, atheism has increased around 30 to 40% on campus. I mean, that's an amazing achievement. And that's because they've done something. They united, they're a movement. And we should take lesson from this. Because it's Allah Jalla wa'ala, He says that the awliya of shaitan, basically, they unite.
Mm.
We should unite too. Mm. Yeah, so we should unite on haqq, on truth, and discuss with people and actually do things.
Mm.
And not fall for this kind of celebrity culture that, you know, okay, so-and-so is doing the job, I don't have to do anything, I could just sit there and just feel high.
Mm.
That's actually wrong, because if you look at the atheist humanist movement, everyone's active. Whether it's on the grassroots, whether they've got stalls, whether they're involved in organizations, whether they're involved online, everyone's doing something. There's no kind of, you know, here are just my leaders and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to learn from that. Everyone has something to say and something to do when it comes to the da'wah and calling people to Allah Jalla wa'ala.
Obviously, there's some of us who live in the West, they don't entirely understand their priorities when it comes to giving da'wah, establishing Islam and so forth. Is there any advice that you could offer such people?
Yes. I think it is. If Allah becomes your priority, then everything falls into place. I mean, our life is full of issues because we don't have Him as a priority. Take, for example, you know, even squabbles between husband and wife. The most ridiculous squabbles you can hear, you know, sometimes. You know, you always use too much water for wudu, or you don't put the lid back on the toothpaste, or, you know, why don't you tell me about these things, you know, whatever. The point is, you have squabbles all the time, and wallahi, if we understood akhirah properly and we understood that our priority is Allah, everything becomes meaningless almost. Everything is meaningless unless Allah gives it meaning. The problem is when you're challenging the meaning that Allah gives it. When we think, no, buying a house is more meaningful for me in my life, or doing this is more meaningful, and doing that is more meaningful. But at the end of the day, aslan, everything is meaningless, I think.
Right.
Because if you think about it, we're just rearrangement of carbon, and it's only of value because Allah has given it meaning. Because intrinsically, why is it good or bad? It's only good or bad because Allah Jalla wa'ala has given it that meaning for us. So everything is meaningless unless Allah gives it meaning. If we lived our life like that, we'd be so happy. I'm telling you. I mean, so many squabbles that we have amongst siblings and family. He looked at me this way and he said this. What did he really mean? I'm like, so what? Just get over yourself. I mean, I'm like that. I actually talk to people like that as well. Like, just get over yourself. You're giving yourself too much self-importance sometimes. And that's what it is. It's like almost the worship of the ego. So I would think if Allah is centered to our life, then everything becomes... It might not become balanced because you may still be excessive in things, but it'll be much more meaningful, and then things won't be trivial. You won't trivialize. I mean, you won't end up dealing with trivial things all the time. Your life will be greater than that. It will be elevated. You will truly have a sense of life, yeah? Because otherwise, if you're, you know, so like wound up about what that person said and how that person thinks about me, or you know. Why was my wife in a bad mood that day? And I mean, this is all irrelevant. Just ignore it. Mm-hmm. Ignore it. I mean, that's what I do now. I just don't remember yesterday.
Right.
I literally don't remember yesterday. Lessons from Yusuf alayhi salam. I mean, when at the end of the amazing story of Yusuf alayhi salam, he says, Allah was merciful to me in the prison. He doesn't mention the well or the palace. Why? Because he had so many calamities, which included the prison, the well, and the palace. The seduction, yeah? So... Some ulama say, like Sheikh Akram Nadwi, he says, well, basically, that's because Yusuf alayhi salam has a noble character. And when someone asks for forgiveness, the past is meaningless. And that's why his brothers, Yusuf alayhi salam's brothers, asked for forgiveness. And the wife of Al-Aziz asked for forgiveness as well. So the seduction was forgiven and forgotten. And the calamity of the well was forgiven and forgotten as well. And Yusuf alayhi salam totally forgets it. To the point, he doesn't even attribute Allah's mercy to it. He attributes Allah's mercy only to the prison because, you know, that's the thing that was of a calamity that was, you know, no one asked for forgiveness for it, essentially. So it shows the noble character of Yusuf alayhi salam. And Yusuf alayhi salam, through this story, is almost trying to tell us, well, Allah is trying to tell us, that the past is meaningless. Once it's forgiven, forgotten, it's meaningless.
Mm.
I think that's powerful, you know?
Yeah.
Obviously, we learn from history, and Allah tells us to learn from history, but I think this to do with like personal matters. Mm. Once someone's forgiven and forgotten, and it's like it become irrelevant, and people have moved on, just forget it. It's irrelevant. Don't live in the past, because you're always if you always use the past as a prism and as lenses to see the present and the future, you'd be always living a circle. You'd be going around in a circle. So, that would be a key piece of advice. I mean, you could talk about so many other different things, but I think this is important.
So, in regards to advice to budding da'is, you know, for if someone wanted to take on this task of challenging some of the atheists, rebuffing some of the atheists, what would you recommend to these brothers who are willing to devote some of their time to doing such activities?
Yeah, get ready for hate. Get ready for hate, get ready for being misrepresented. Yeah. That's one thing, yeah. There's so much rubbish online about du'a to do with atheists. But khair, I mean, it depends what your strategy is. If it's direct da'wah to atheists, or if it's to empower the Muslims, you need to make a decision, because sometimes you can't do both. You can and you can't. I mean, what I would advise is, make sure you have a solid reading in aqidah, because you don't want to make the mistakes that I made in the evolution of giving da'wah to the atheists. That basically, you know, you end up having to learn things the hard way. So sit with a scholar or with a student of knowledge and just go for a basic aqidah book, aqidah tahawiyah or something, and go through it, because it's important, because it will shape how you would discuss with the atheists and what you'd have to say. and it would empower you, and you won't feel depressed when you can't answer certain questions, and you won't feel low, because when you do study Aqidah, you see Islam in a totally different perspective. So if you do that, that's important. The other thing is to understand there's a difference between the leadership of atheists and atheists themselves.
Right.
Atheists themselves are normal human beings that you need to be compassionate with. Look what Musa alayhi salam was told by Allah Jalla wa Ala to speak nicely and kindly to Fir'aun. Al-Qurtubi, the classical exegete, who explained the Quran, said, well, if we have to basically speak nicely to, if Musa had to speak nicely to Fir'aun, imagine us speaking to everybody else. So we have to speak very nicely to people. But when it comes to leadership, then you have to be very clear and firm with your kind of beliefs and have a stance. And I don't think you should waver, and, you know, really have clear, distinct, robust, coherent arguments. Yeah, you have to have clear, distinct, robust, coherent arguments that are based and they're premised on the Quran and the Sunnah. Because if they're not, then you won't have a coherent argument and you will get caught out. And that's why I would say, you know, we should follow the Taymiyyan approach, Ibn Taymiyyah, rahimahullah, because he would basically always use argumentation that was in line with the Quran and the Sunnah. So you don't end up saying things just to win an argument, but then it just actually negates certain principles in Islam or our view on who Allah Jalla wa Ala is. So yeah, get knowledge from a scholar, sit with someone on with a creed, with a book on creed, speak nicely to everybody. But when it comes to leadership, you know, if you're going to have public discussions, do so with a stance, and an unwavering stance, but couch it in human language. The other thing I would add is, start writing. Start using a repertoire of activities like podcasts, writing, blogs. We don't have enough people doing that. And that helps create a movement, because it's not just about debates. I mean, debates are almost irrelevant to this. They're just part of the movement. The most important thing is lecturing and teaching other Muslims and empowering them, doing podcasts.
Like this one?
Yeah, social media. Because it's very important. Because if you study social movements from the 1500s, the key thing is that you have leaders, but you also have many organizations coming together under a certain banner, certain idea, but also you have a repertoire of social activities, which is just do as much as you can. So don't just focus on one thing: websites, webinars, workshops, teaching others, debates, discussions, lectures, dialogues, inshallah. And also, well, last most important thing, make sure you link it to spirituality. Make sure you do it for the sake of Allah, otherwise it's pointless. There'll be no barakah in your work. And make sure that you basically try and develop yourself from a tarbiyah perspective, so you come close to Allah, because there will be challenges and you need to have firm iman and you need to be close to Him in order to deal with these challenges, like all the prophets. You can't just rely on a basically basic level of spirituality. You need to be reading Quran every day, doing dhikr every day. These are the basic things. If you don't do them, then you know you need to refocus, because they're going to strengthen you. And I've realized that in my own life. When you're slightly away from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, your da'wah becomes harder, and it's like running through treacle. But when you're closer to Allah, it just becomes so easy. And the other thing is, be yourself. Be yourself. It's very important, because people listen to people who are authentic. If you don't have an authenticity about you, then we have this internal radar that people understand, you know, this guy, there's something wrong with him. So be yourself, inshallah.
As I mentioned, you're known for your debates and your ability to speak. Is this something that you always had, or is it something that you developed?
That's a good question. I think the motivation was there, but it's something I definitely developed. And I think what I realized, one lesson is just be yourself and just practice. Just do it. You know, some people think read a book and you become a better speaker. But I think when people read a book, they don't become authentic speakers. Because the irony is, those books about how to be a good speaker is modeled on good speakers. But the irony is, those good speakers never read a book on how to be a good speaker. So, it does help. Because my thing would be, observe other people, other good speakers. Like, I used to observe Malcolm X all the time. Like, observe good speakers, but just do it. And then, as and when you do it, after the 100th speech or lecture, you just become better at it. And have ikhlas, sincerity, and be your own worst critic, and always trying to improve and develop from there.
You mentioned something interesting, and that was when someone wants to enter this field of giving dawah, specifically towards atheists or non-Muslims, that they should be prepared for hatred, basically.
Yeah, of course.
How do you personally deal with such
hatred? Oh, I ignore it hatred, now. Before, it used to really bother me. Like, oh, he's misrepresenting my argument. They've used rhetoric. It looks like they've refuted me. But I'm thinking, you know, it's one thing my wife said, which was quite powerful. It made me cry. I was having this online discussion with a bunch of atheists, and it was the worst thing. I mean, it was a total failure and flop. Because I was like, you know, there's too many people there. They didn't let me speak properly. And it was terrible. And I felt so deflated, I wanted to quit. And she was like, look at you, she said. The Prophet ﷺ was doing this for 23 years, and for 13 years he was so deflated, he was hated and tortured and abused, and this one couple of hours you're online, you feel all depressed. And I just felt so happy, and it was quite emotional, because I thought, you know, you're living like the prophetic life in a way. Not that we attribute piety to ourselves, we don't in any shape or form, but it's just inevitable when you just walk in the shadow of the Prophet ﷺ, you're just going to end up being hated like he was. So it's mabruk, it's good news. It's good news, man. So that's how I see it now. And then I don't respond to any of it, because you let the work speak for itself. But if something needs responding, you should. But you shouldn't respond to everything, no. Let the dogs bark. Dogs will bark at the caravans of truth. So let them bark.
All right. So you've touched on something very important, and that is, how vital is it to have a spouse that that sees the importance of dawah?
Oh, very important. And that's why you should never marry a feminist. my sister is pious, who, you know, loves Allah, and you see that, and she loves you as a result. And instead of her, you being at home, she rather you be outside. For example, you know, you know what, it's your fault. One thing yours, our brother's fault, because we always think, yeah, I'm going to spend time with you, I'm going to be a great husband, I'm going to be Mr. Islamo Superman, and I aspire to be this, and that's all rubbish. Because I think the best advice to give, I think, in my experience, is just tell them all your bad faults before you marry them. Before you say anything good about yourself, mention everything bad, and give them the right expectations. So say things like, you know, all your bad points. And if they could live with the bad points, then you can have a relatively good marriage. Mm. And not just that, say what your life is going to be. Like, for example, you should say something like, if you want to get involved in the Dawah, you say, you know, say, for example, we've booked a holiday for the family for a week. But in that week, you get invited by the BBC on a very important discussion, and you're probably the only person that can do it. What do you do? I mean, I would cancel the holiday. And my wife, okay, she'd be upset, but don't know why it happened. If in that scenario, your wife reacts in a positive way, then you've been blessed.
Sure.
But that's one in a million. Yeah. Sure. No, it's not, actually it's not, because our sisters are very good. It's about expectations. Yeah. And we have to give the right expectations. I think what's also very important as well is we have to, you know, if Allah is everyone's priority, then everything should be fine. Mm-hmm. Everything should be fine. So obviously you're going to have ups and downs. But when you do spend time with them. Put your BlackBerry or your phone away. Don't touch it. And it's about quality, not quantity, I guess. And really be in the moment with them. You know, enjoy your family as best as possible. But when it comes to the Dawah, if she understands from the beginning, before you get married, that this is a priority, then she'll always know. She'll know that we'll have to sacrifice things, we'll have to cancel things last minute, or we'll have to basically not live a normal life. It's not a 9-to-5 life. And if they do that, then, you know, they'll be happy. And, you know, get your kids trained like that. I mean, something that got me very moved me the other day is on my mum. My mum's not Muslim, right? But she's always worried about me. She's on my Facebook. She sees what I do, yeah? And she was talking to my son, Zakaria. He's only 6 years old. He was like, you know, tell your baba he works too hard. What is he doing? He'll spend time with you. And then Zakaria replied, don't worry, Gran. He's doing it for Allah. And that was quite moving.
Inshallah.
And I didn't train him to say that. It's probably my wife or something. So, yeah. So, that's what you need to do. It's not easy, though. It's not easy. It is very hard. I mean, it is extremely hard. Especially if you're traveling a lot and stuff like that. But it's just a thing that you have to do. I mean, you know, most of the Sahaba didn't die in Mecca and Medina. So, That's it.
Now, going back to your journey, after becoming a Muslim and so forth. How did you join up with IRA? Or become involved with IRA?
It was an accident. Because I basically, I believe I met them. I don't remember why and how. Oh, yes. Someone cancelled this Dawah day that they were having in this mosque. And they needed someone to replace that person. And they and the people of, on the committee of the masjid were associated with some brothers. And those brothers said they recommended me. It's to do with the linguistic miracle of the Quran or something. And that's how they met me, before they had IRA. And then they introduced the idea to me. And I was like, okay, fine. Maybe let's try and do this or whatever. But I wasn't really involved. And then I lost my job. Well, I had to leave because I was doing Dawah before and they found out. And there was this foundation that is like a pro-secular liberal foundation that basically tried to slander me, link me to this crazy stuff happening in Bangladesh because I was a trustee of a charity, and it's all lies. Anyway, the point is I had to leave because it was a government organization. And I had to leave before I got sacked. So I was jobless. So I sent an email to the brother saying, you know, if you need any help for anything, let me know. I've got project management experience. So they took me on board, not as paid, but just to volunteer to help them do the launch tour. So I tried to plan it for them, and I said, you know what? I'm not getting involved in this because you've got 4 weeks and you're doing this massive tour. Forget it. But you know what? Allah made it happen. So they made me be the kind of, not the speaker, but the, what do you call it?
Supplementary speaker?
No, I was like the guy who introduced the speakers and managed the events.
Right.
Yeah, the MC, if you like.
Right.
And then they wanted me to do some research for, some basic research for some statistics about Muslim perceptions. And then they said, you know what? Come on board. Come as a researcher and as a speaker and as a trainer for Dawah. Because Abdurrahim Group couldn't make Malaysia, so he told me to deliver a course on his behalf in Malaysia. So all these things that were like almost like accidents. Obviously they're not accidents, but you know what I'm trying to say. They basically saw me and said, okay, well, he can train people in Dawah. He can speak. He does a bit of research. This is what we need for IRA. So I got involved in the early team. There's only about 4 or 5 of us.
And when was this?
Oh, this was in 2009.
Okay.
I think it was 2009, yeah. June, July, August 2009. And be with them ever since. So,
right. You have a very interesting story about finding a book related to the linguistic miracles of the
Quran. Oh, yes, yes. In the early period of my conversion, in the first 3 months, it was like pure bliss. But then after, I was challenged by somebody, and it really reduced my iman to like nearly zero. And my mind was like nearly unconvinced. But my heart was, and my soul was still screaming for Islam. So it was a bit of a very interesting time. So I said, I need to basically clarify and find out this information to do with the literary miracle of the Quran. But at that time, there was no Sheikh Nomali Khan. There was no one popularizing this stuff. Then I had no access to like students of knowledge of the time. I had no clue what to do. So I said, let me just do it myself. I was in British Library. I was doing my own research. I tried to develop the website, theinimitablequran.com. And I was doing as much as I can. Now, in the process, I was sitting in the British Library and I found this amazing thesis that was done by somebody in Scotland, a PhD thesis. And it was on the inimitability of the Quran, the matchlessness of the Quran. I said, this is exactly what I need. It's English. I could popularize this. I could use it as part of the argument. Anyway, so I had to wait a few months for it, but British Library basically couldn't get it because they didn't get the authorization from that university. So, you know, I was a bit depressed, thinking, what am I going to do? You know, I was trying to really make a robust argument out of this. So what happened was is, I said, that's it. I give up, I can't do this on my own. I need to start from scratch. So I said, let me just learn the Arabic language or try and learn it. So I called my old language, online language institute called Talk Languages at the time. And I said, I want someone, because I used to learn Mandarin for a year. So I said, I want someone who knows Arabic, you know, the 7 styles of the Quran. I want him to know balagha, rhetoric, everything. I found someone. So it was like quite a trip away. It was quite expensive, but I would travel to his house. So the first time I went to see him, I explained to him my story. I'm getting these doubts. I need to reform this argument. But my soul loves Islam. And I know it's the true, you know, fitrah. I know it's true. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I explained everything to him, and you know, I said I'll go to the British Library and I need to get this thesis. I couldn't find it, and I'm all like depressed. And anyway, then he stood up and he walked to his drawer and he gave me the thesis, and he was actually the author. and it was phenomenal because we prayed Maghrib, and then he started crying in Salah. He's actually a scholar from Al Azhar University. His name is Dr. Sami Al Halawani. He comes from the famous Al Halawani family. So,
And I remember you mentioning Abdurrahim Green saying something to you.
Yeah, Abdurrahim Green said to me after I told him the story, he said, if you don't believe in God after this, then you're an idiot. And it's true. So, yeah, so that was it really. And I think that taught me, if you walk to Allah, Allah would hurry towards you. And that's in the da'wah as well, inshallah. You just have to have sabr, have to have patience.
Now, going to your debates, just so we can get introduced in regards to what you actually do with your debates, is there a process that you undertake before entering into a debate?
Oh yeah, there is. You have to know what you're talking about. And not only do you have to know what you're talking about, you have to have an argument that is coherent and it's structured, and that you basically know most of the contentions against the argument, because the debate is not just about producing a case, because they'll have contentions and counter arguments that you'll have to know your argument well enough to actually respond. And that's why it's very important to basically train yourself and develop that. Now, you may think, well, that might not be the case for Mr. Hamza, and that's true, because mine was just an evolution. I had a very simple argument and I just copied someone else, and I didn't know any contentions, but I just jumped in there, and Allah made it easy, yeah? But don't fall for that mistake, because you could end up making blunders, and don't learn from those mistakes. So, you know, have a structured argument, know some of the contentions, and learn how to articulate it in a structured manner. That's very important. And then develop yourself from there. And at the end of the day, debates may not be the thing that you want to do. It may not be that important. It may be that you want to train people on this, or empower people on this, or do discussions instead, or write. Debates are just one avenue. It's just one avenue. But if you do go into them, you know, make sure you go into them properly by being well prepared and having a structured argument, and you have good background information. And don't forget, try and Islamify your arguments as well. Because in the beginning, I never Islamified my arguments, but then after now, they're more Islamic now. So I use the Quran as an argument, and even with God's existence, I link it to Quranic verses. So it's very important to do that. So it shows the robustness and the coherence of our own worldview.
Right. For the listeners, I do apologize. There seems to be a school excursion in the background. In any case, what are some of the popular arguments that you would recommend using when dealing with atheists, or that perhaps that you've used yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's about four key arguments that you can use. Number one, the argument for the beginning of the universe, which shows that an uncreated creator exists. Number two, the inimitability of the Quran, the fact that you can't explain the Quran naturalistically because of its linguistic miracle, its numerical coherence, its preservation, its multi-leveled and multi-layered meaning. Number three, the argument from design, that there's design in the cosmos, that this universe is based on laws and values and constants that they were fine-tuned to permit our life, make sense of a cosmic designer. And also the life of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that if you look at his life, you see, based on his psychological profile and the experiences, that he couldn't be a liar, he couldn't be deluded, he couldn't be lying and deluded, he must be speaking the truth. So these are key arguments, I think, and very almost irrefutable. I mean, there's not many contentions, and when you learn the arguments against the contentions, you have a robust kind of world view. But, you know, in saying that, don't think that these arguments intrinsically lead to guidance. They don't. It's Allah that guides. Remember that. And these arguments are only there to wake up the fitrah, and you have to really appreciate that. Because if you think the arguments are ends in and of themselves, that's wrong. You have to realize they're there, they're robust enough to wake up the fitrah, the innate disposition, so they realize that their life should be about worshipping Allah Jalla wa Ala.
One of the popular arguments which is used in regards to combating atheism and so forth is the Kalam cosmological argument.
Yes.
Can you briefly just explain that for our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, there's various variations of the Kalam cosmological argument. Some variations are not Islamic. Yeah, like Yasir Qadi, a scholar, he basically makes some valid points against the cosmological argument when he talks about the prime mover. because it goes against some key aspects of our theology, which is fine. But there are more modern versions of the cosmological argument that actually are Quranic. Like Allah Jalla wa Ala, he mentions in chapter 52, verse 35 to 36, he talks about the creation of the human being and says, you know, did you come from nothing? Did you create yourself? Or did you create the heavens and the earth? Now, the verses here basically give you four explanations about the origins of things that begin. And that could include the universe. Like Dr. Jafar Idris talks about this. It could apply to the origins of the universe. So if the universe began, yeah, they came from nothing, or it came via nothing. It created itself. It was created by something else created ultimately, or ultimately created by something that was uncreated. And when you work through these options, you see that the best explanation that it was created by something uncreated. Because from nothing, nothing comes. If something emerged, it came into being from non-being, there must have been something there, like God's creative power, for example. So from nothing, nothing comes. It couldn't create itself because that implies that something exists and doesn't exist at the same time. It also implies that, you know, your mother could give birth to herself, which is absurd. It couldn't be created by something created because ultimately that would lead to an infinite regress. And as Ibn Taymiyyah said, you can't have an infinite regress of causes. I know Ibn Taymiyyah talked about you can't have an infinite regress of events, but that's a different theological discussion. But he said you can't have an infinite regress of causes because how could one cause get its causal power from another cause? And if that goes on forever, you never have the first cause having causal power. You know, I usually give the sniper example. If I wanted to shoot a bird as a sniper, yeah? And I have to ask permission from the person behind me. If that goes on forever, I will never shoot the bird. So ultimately, there must have been an uncreated creator. That's the most rational explanation. And Professor Philosopher Abraham Varghese, he makes a good point. He says, look, atheists and theists, they do agree on one thing, that something has always been there. Something has always been eternal to explain things. And he says, pick your choice, either God or the universe. But since the universe began, and we can prove it mathematically and via cosmology, and we could prove it scientifically, if it began, therefore it makes sense that God is the uncreated creator. And then when you reflect upon this, you know that this uncreated creator must be eternal, must be powerful, must be knowing, must be one, must have a will. Based on conceptual analysis, thinking deeply about what this uncreated creator is. So therefore that's in line with the Islamic conception of Allah, and it doesn't contradict Islamic theology at all. But other versions of the argument do, like the prime mover. Right. So that would be a form of the cosmological argument that I think is very, very strong.
Right.
There are some contentions. For example, they would say, you know, causality doesn't exist out of time. And you'd be like, well, that's not true. You've undermined physics, because there's many conceptions of the origin of the universe that time and space began, but before it there was this kind of quantum haze or something. So therefore there is a causal link between time and space and the quantum haze. But that's basically outside of physical time, because time and space emerged from this quantum haze, do you see? You could also argue, like Ibn Taymiyyah argued, that actually, well, things could be the same in time. Something could be not prior in time, but it could be prior in course. And Immanuel Kant gave an example of an eternal ball and an eternal pillow. Now, they're both eternal, so time doesn't make any, time is not an issue here. But you're not going to say that the indentation of the pillow that is basically not as a result of the ball. It is. But although they're both eternal, you can't say which one came first. But the point is, there is a causal link between the weight of the ball and the indentation of the pillow. So something could be prior causally, but not prior in time. So there are many counter arguments to this, and you could even argue, well, maybe there's metaphysical time as well. So it's not a key argument, it doesn't undermine the argument itself. The other contention to this argument may be, well, look at quantum physics. You know, things can come out of nothing, and they cite particles coming out from the quantum vacuum. Well, this is wrong, because the quantum vacuum is something. If you look at the works of Christopher Hay and Polkinghorne and Alexander Vilenkin, you know, thinkers and philosophers and scientists in this field, they say, well, the quantum vacuum is not nothing. It's a sea of fluctuating energy. It's a highly structured entity. So the particles came from something. So there's actually not many contentions, to be honest, and it doesn't undermine the argument at all. So it's a very strong argument, I believe. And I think I've used it against so many academics and thinkers, and they haven't really provided any undercutting defeaters. They haven't defeated the argument in its totality. So
just to wrap up, obviously I'd like to keep the discussion going, but unfortunately you've got a plane to catch very soon. So just to wrap up, can you briefly summarize how do you personally feel when you're spending so much time, devoting so much time to defending Islam, defending Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's religion?
I've got a wealth of things in the car.
Yes. Well, at the end of the day, it gives you life. You have a sense of life about you. Because, there's two types of Muslims. The dead Muslim and there's a live Muslim. And I describe the dead Muslim, the Muslim who doesn't respond to Allah's call. And it's simple as that. You know, you live a 9-to-5 life, buy a house, get married, have kids, and then die. Well done. Jazakallahu khair. But Allah Jalla wa'ala wants to give you life, and that's why he says in the Quran, Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu istajibu lillahi wa li rasuli idha da'akum lima yuhikum. Oh, you have believed, respond to the call of Allah and His Messenger to that which gives you life. And Imam Bukhari said, responding to the call is the response to all that is good, and all that is good is Islam. So responding to Islam and the call, which is to Allah's worship and calling to other people to His worship, gives you life. So if you want life, do it. If you want to be dead Muslim walking, stay asleep.
Okay. I think that's a perfect way to end this particular podcast. Jazakumullah khair. I thank you for your time.
No worries, bro.
And I thank you for all the advice you've given us. Jazakumullah khair.
Is that the time?
Yeah.
Bro, I'm going to miss my flight.
Let's go.